Hello and welcome to this one-on-one conversation with Inu Manuk that we're going to run at the ESIP Global Economy podcast. My name is Fredrik Eriksson, and before going into today's topic and presenting today's guest, let me also say that this is going to be the 100th episode of our podcast, so it's time for us to celebrate as well, not least for all the fascinating and thought-provoking conversations we have hosted over the last years with academics, journalists, analysts, thinkers, and policymakers. And who better to have here for our 100th episode than Inu Manuk, a friend of many of us at ESIP and a returning guest to the podcast as well. Inu is a fellow for trade policy at the Council on Foreign Relations in America. She's an expert on many matters related to trade policy. And she is and has been affiliated with many key institutions on trade policy research in America and Europe. She has a PhD from Georgetown and is the author of a book on special and differential treatment in trade called The Development Dimension. Inu, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me here.
So we're recording this conversation 2 days after the US election, and the obvious topic for today is US trade policy going forward and what we could expect coming from a second Trump administration. So can we start there? What are your expectations? Will we see a US that follows what seems to be the recent US political consensus of trade, which includes broad support for strategic tariff protection against China, a manufacturing first approach, dismissive attitudes to international trade rules and institutions? Or do you expect Trump will do what he says and that he will go ahead with very significant tariff hikes across the board?
I think this is something that we're all thinking about a lot in Washington right now. What is Trump going to do? I think a good indicator of that is to look at what he did in the past, where we did see sort of broad-based efforts to raise protectionist measures against both friends and enemies in his mind. But we also saw sort of really erratic behavior on changing policies quite frequently, not quite knowing where they were going to stand. I would take him very seriously, maybe not literally. So when he says he's going to impose high tariffs, I bet he's going to do it. What that number is, 10, 20, 60%, I'm not quite sure, but we're soon going to find out. So I think that we should be prepared to listen to what he has said so far and to really understand that he's going to do something and deliver on the promises that he's made on the campaign trail.
And if that's going to be the development, I suppose there will be some differentiation between countries that perhaps have a closer relation to America economically and countries that may have maybe more of a strategically and hostile countries in Trump's mind. So a distinction between at least North American trading partners in Canada and Mexico taking more of a hostile view against China. Do you think that's the approach?
Certainly. I think, you know, China's going to be targeted right out the gate. I think we're likely going to see an increase in tariffs against China, whether that's going to be through modifying the existing actions that already are in place through the Section 301 tariffs. That's what Trump used initially to launch his trade war against China, and the Biden administration left all those tariffs in place. So he could essentially just make those higher across the board if he wants to. But when it comes to how he thinks about his relationship with close trading partners, I think that Trump sees this more as a way to get leverage, to get them to do more for the United States, right? So I could see him saying, you know, we're going to apply tariffs, they're going to apply to everyone, and then you can ask for exclusions to that blanket rule if you're willing to give us something in return. So we saw this with the Section 232 tariffs on steel and aluminum that were applied broadly to our allies as well. And they had to kind of clamor to figure out ways to avoid those tariffs. So even when it comes to our really closest trading partners like Canada and Mexico, I don't think that they're safe from any tariff action at the end of the day, that Trump will not be afraid to take actions that are going to get these countries to come to the table and negotiate something. Because remember, he prides himself as a deal maker. He's going to want to go out there and make some quick deals, even if it means those countries might get those exclusions anyways. It's not going to be an easy process to do so.
And I think this is also goes to the issue about sort of the two faces of Donald Trump, so to speak, which is on the one hand, you see a Donald Trump who is out for revenge. So he is the man who stands down there in a podium and talks to people and say, I am your retribution. And in trade policy, that would basically mean not being afraid of taking measures that are going to be detrimental to many, many different countries, regardless of their economic consequences, also for America. But on the other hand, you have the view of Donald Trump, which is that he is very transactional. He's a mercurial type of person. And as you say, he wants to use this at leverage, using maximum advantage for America. And if he can pressure out sort of a deal with China on U.S.-American soy, or if he can negotiate something more out of Europe, he's going to take it. So where do you think, sort of, where is Trump in that balance of different political personalities now? Do you think he's more on the retribution side now, coming back in a second time, and of course having been fighting a very, very strong political war over the last years?
Yeah, I think when he comes back, he's probably going to focus a little bit on sort of settling some scores or making examples of countries that he feel wronged the United States or him personally, right? So I think he's going to start with kind of targeting certain countries, looking at potentially the trade deficit, where the U.S. has a trade deficit with some partners, and focusing on those countries in particular. But I think overall, if we look at what happened in the past, I would imagine that we're going to see some moderation of that in terms of creating some leverage to actually negotiate something. So we're likely to see Ambassador Bob Lighthizer come back. He was the U.S. Trade Representative under Trump's first term. It's not clear whether he's going to be U.S. Trade Representative again, but we do know that he is helping to craft Trump's overall economic policy right now in the transition. So if you look at his approach, he used maximum pressure as a way to get countries to the negotiating table, to try to get better concessions from them, and I would imagine he's going to do the same this time around as well.
And do you think they have other strategies or instruments that they're looking at as well in trade? Or is it still a very much tariff-first type of policy that they are looking at?
I certainly think tariffs are going to come first. That's going to be a major focus of Trump's policies, because, you know, it's easy for the president to enact tariffs, as we've seen in his last term in office. The U.S. Laws allow for plenty of discretion for the president to enact tariffs, even though that power resides with Congress, right? Congress has delegated a lot of those authority ways over the years. But in terms of other actions, I would imagine that he would potentially expand that. We don't know quite yet what he thinks about subsidies, for example. Subsidies are going to be a little bit more challenging because he'd have to pass that legislatively and get appropriations from Congress. He has criticized the CHIPS Act. It's not really clear whether he's criticizing it just because it was a Biden initiative or whether he actually is against it. If we look at some of those investments, they're actually going into states that heavily supported Trump as well. So he may not have an incentive to reverse some of those policies at all, but he may want to maybe bolster them. So there is a chance that he could do so, particularly if we have a joint Senate and House, right? So right now, House races are uncalled. It's a really close race. But if we have Republicans controlling both the House and the executive branch, I would imagine that we're going to see potentially some more industrial policy. So I think that's certainly in the cards. The other thing that we've seen talked about so far has been potentially tinkering with fiscal policy and monetary policy. Trump has said that he wants to have a deregulatory environment that's going to help encourage innovation. But there's also been this idea that we should devalue the dollar in order to make U.S. exports more competitive. So I think there's a whole range of different issues that they may pursue. It all just depends on the order in which they do them and potentially the priority that he decides to place on one or the other. But I would say tariffs are definitely going to come first.
I also noted the other day that there are all talks about different type of capital controls. Also, I suppose, designed in order to attract more investments going into America. But strangely, there are also talk about capital controls which are going to help outflow of investments in order to, as you say, depreciate the dollar and in that way try to increase U.S. exports. Do you think an administration would seriously go into capital control type of issues as well?
I think it's certainly possible. I mean, if we look at what Ambassador Lighthizer has talked about in the last several months, he has touched on the issue of capital controls. Recently, he wrote something that talked about putting a fee on those who are wanting to invest in the United States. I would imagine he would have the ability to make that happen. But on the outbound investment issue, I think that's been something that's been percolating for quite some time. We've saw over the last several years, Congress trying to develop some sort of rules on this. The Biden administration sort of got ahead of them and created an executive order to think about outbound investment screening. And the Treasury Department has been trying to work out what that would look like. At the moment, it seems like a lot of it's just monitoring, understanding the data behind where U.S. companies are investing. But it's certainly possible that the executive branch could take this action a lot further. And I would say that broadly, anxiety over U.S. investments in China could be really driving a change to the U.S. outbound investment regime. But there's also a potential that there's going to be some more oversight of all the investments coming in as well. So I think that these are not outside the realm of possibility.
I'm going to come back to issues around relation to other parts of the world. But before that, just one question more on perhaps election-related issue. You already said it that at the time we're speaking, the House remains uncalled. And of course, it's going to matter how the majority relations are going to stack up in both the Senate and House of Representatives. On the election, though, I mean, is it your impression that many of the Republicans that have been elected to the Senate and the Congress, are they in the Trump fold of trade policy? Or do you also see sort of some more of that old traditional Republican trade stances, especially in those states that are maybe strong on agricultural exports and that may be concerned about an attitude which is, frankly, is going to lead to reaction against what they sell abroad and probably going to lead to problems for them?
I think we have retained some of the more moderate Republicans that have been really pro free trade for a very long time. But on balance, I think what we're facing in a Republican-led Senate is a Senate that will essentially rubber stamp a lot of what Trump wants to do. I mean, we saw this the last time around. There was not significant pushback against any of Trump's tariff policies, and Republicans had the ability to actually push back. They could have made changes to Section 232 on the steel aluminum tariffs. They could have pushed back a little bit more on getting more information on what was happening in terms of the investigation on Section 301 tariffs with China, but they just didn't. And they had the ability to rein in a lot of presidential authority, and they just stopped themselves from doing that. Part of that is the party unity, and the Republican Party is very strong, and they don't try to veer away from whatever Trump wants to get done. So I think it's going to be really difficult, absent Democrats pushing back, that we're going to see actual debate on some of these issues that Trump is going to want to push through the Congress.
All right. Now, I mean, as you just mentioned, we have had those Section 232 tariffs under the first Trump administration. And I mean, in plain speak, what it basically means is that you take national security motivated actions against other countries. And he also did it against allies, which, of course, leads to the question about, is he capable of distinguishing allies from other countries? I mean, I'm thinking about it now when we look at how the world is unfolding. He started off his last administration being pretty hostile to a country like South Korea, for instance. And what happens in East Asia seems to be pretty important for the entire strategic outlook for what the second Trump administration will do. And of course, China is the dominant issue there. What's your expectation here when it comes to the Asian strategic outlook? Will that help to shape how they're going to think about trade vis-a-vis the sort of strong U.S. trading partners in the region like South Korea, Japan, Taiwan?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of hard to see how they're going to build up enough partnerships within the region to sort of hedge against China. If we look at his past approach, you know, Trump is very transactional. But in addition to that, he doesn't like to deal with groupings of countries. You know, he doesn't like the multilateral trading system. He doesn't like plurilaterals. He wants bilateral relations. If you look at their 2017 national security strategy that his administration put out, they emphasize bilateral trade relations as something that they would focus on. So I would imagine that a lot of what he might do is to essentially have negotiations with just one country at a time, that they this they have maximum leverage, essentially, right? Because you do get power diluted when there's too many people around the table. And I think that's his big concern. What I would expect pretty quickly out of the gate is that he would end the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework. That's the initiative that the Biden administration started to sort of deepen ties in the Indo-Pacific, sort of a replacement for the CPTPP, but not really, because it doesn't include any trade pillar or market access of any sort. You know, on the other hand, I would say Trump may actually try to pursue some market access as he did in his first term. Is it going to look anything like a TPP? No. But we may see that he will reach out to some partners in the region and try to build up ties one-on-one with them. So that is one way that he could do it. Obviously, it's not going to be as powerful as creating some sort of broader framework in the region like the TPP. But I think that he's certainly going to try to win over some of those countries and win them away from China.
Yeah, and that seems to be the strategic imperative here, right? I mean, if you're serious about trying to reduce the potential influence now and in the future for a country like China, you need to offer an opportunity to other countries in the region, and for them not to be pulled into that enormously strong economic centrifugal power which is there with the Chinese economy.
Absolutely. You know, he's going to need to get partners on our side, right? It's not so easy just to say, you must do this, otherwise we're not going to work with you. He's going to have to create incentives for that cooperation. And I think he's well aware of that. His team is well aware of that. And they understand that the Indo-Pacific region is so critical for U.S. influence. And so this is something that I do think they are going to prioritize, but it's going to be a mix of taking action against China and then also trying to find a way to compel our allies to choose us instead of China to the extent that they can. So we're going to see a little bit more talk about maybe de-risking and decoupling amplified in that next conversation.
And let's turn to another region in the world, Europe. I think the expectation in Europe is basically that they're going to be basically treated in the same fashion as they were treated in the first Trump administration, which is be treated with some degree of disgust. Trump, as you said, doesn't like to engage with multi-country different type of force. He feels less powerful and probably feel a bit disoriented also in atmospheres like that. I think the expectation too is that he's going to come after Europe. Europe runs a trade surplus with America, and that trade surplus for many countries, including Germany, has grown quite substantially as Europe also struggles with this de-risking strategy vis-a-vis China. So there are lots of concerns there. I think on the European side, there are also concerns about being caught up in more US-China conflicts. At least one ingredient in this problem that Europe has with the feeling of being overwashed with cheap EVs coming from China is that the Biden administration made it more difficult to export to Europe, and some of that export from China was reshuffled to Europe, leading to price cuts and very cheap Chinese EVs taking market shares from the big European brands. So they're concerned about that as well. But that's meant so many questions. So where do we start with? What do you think is Trump's general trade outlook to Europe? I mean, Lighthizer, he wasn't very friendly towards Europe. I think his experience going back to the 1980s under the Reagan administration, his experience as a trade lawyer representing a lot of sunset industries in America was basically that America had been given Europe far too many advantages in trade over far too long time, and now it's basically time to get payback for that in history. What do you think is the broad attitude now?
I would think there's going to be a lot of continuity with what we saw in the past Trump administration in terms of the attitude towards Europe, which is kind of focused on two things. One is that, as you mentioned, the trade surplus. That's something that Trump has complained about for a very long time, that we need to have more reciprocal and balanced trade. So I do think there's going to be some effort to deal with that. He's really upset about the potential unfairness, how the EU takes its role in regulating global trade, whether that be through the carbon border adjustment mechanism and other things like the deforestation regulation that I think is going to be particularly annoying for him as he goes out and talks to our European friends and allies about this. But also, I think a lot of this gets wrapped up into sort of the defense and national security discussions, where he's often said that he's not happy that, you know, Europe is not, dealing with its own security, that the United States has been providing the security umbrella and we're not seeing Europe stand up as well. So I think in that backdrop, he kind of sees the United States as doing a huge favor to the EU and its partner countries, and that they, you know, owe us back. And so he's going to look for a way to balance that relationship again. You know, it is really unfortunate that we did not find a way to conclude the talks on global steel between the EU under the Biden administration. So I think steel is going to be a consistent point of pressure, and we're going to see that come back again. We certainly will see potentially more tariffs coming back, and I think that it's unfortunate we didn't get a chance to settle this dispute, but it may sort of come out in a different way as the United States also potentially pursues some sort of carbon tariff, but without a border adjustment. So it's going to be no domestic carbon tax and potentially just a tariff to match what they think the Europeans are doing. So I think it's going to be a really contested time, and one in which we're going to have to find ways to speak to each other about our common interests and find those pathways, because they are there and they exist. It's just a matter of kind of changing the conversation towards something that's a little bit more productive. Because at the end of the day, I think we have a lot of shared interests and values. And so I think that the Trump administration is going to come out trying to push Europe to change, but we have to sort of have a bigger conversation about how we can evolve some of these things together and work together for a lot of these problems, especially when dealing with China, as you mentioned.
Yeah, and that perhaps is also one of the differences between Trump 1 and Trump 2, in the sense that the starting point right now is not that he feels Europe to be on a different planet when it comes to concerns with China. I mean, Europe has largely moved in the same direction as America and what basically Trump started with, a lot more economic security measures, a broad strategy, which is to Europe calls it de-risk, but what it basically means is to wean themselves off different type of dependencies that they have on trade with China. And that's largely sort of in the strategic economic interest of Donald Trump, to have Europe sort of folding into that American strategy, I would imagine. Another touch point may be that at least some countries in Europe have responded to what was Trump's call on NATO military spending on 2% of GDP. Now, of course, he's saying 3% of GDP, and I think some European countries are going in that direction anyway. But what I think may be the important point here is that when you increase military spending as fast as you do in Europe right now, you're not going to find supply of defense industry products coming from Europe. So Europe is now importing a lot of defense industry products and services from America. When you look at the trade balance on defense now, I mean, it's just been exploding over the past couple of years. And I would imagine that is something that speaks to the mind of someone like Donald Trump as well, which is that, all right, so here, even if there is a general trade surplus, which have been increasing, on strategic goods, Europe seems to be buying a lot more from America than what America is buying from Europe. So perhaps there's something to build on here.
Certainly, you know, and I think at the end of the day, Europe investing in its own security is a very positive thing, right? You don't want to be 100% dependent on the United States when it comes to that. But also, you're right that there's a point of commonality here where we can really work together to support that. And I think that's something where Trump certainly would see that as a positive thing, in particular to support sort of the U.S. defense industrial base as well. In helping Europe achieve its own ability to take care of its own neighborhood. So I think that's something that I could see is a lot of potential for cooperation on, and where we can find some common ground that may lay the groundwork for cooperation on other things as well.
I would argue, and I'm curious to hear what you think about this, watching it from America, but I would also argue that Europe has quite a lot of agency in this development. In the first place, we can, here in this part of the world, we can think that sort of Trump's trade policy is pretty mad. On the other hand, if we hold up a mirror and look ourselves into the mirror, we're also going to see some madness in our trade policy, or at least in our general economic external policies. You mentioned the deforestation regulation, which at least some parts of the EU institutional framework has decided to delay for a year. We're still waiting for a parliament vote on if they're going to agree to delaying the implementation for a year as well. But I think it's pretty decent chances for that to happen. We have a couple of other things coming in over the next couple of years in Europe that I would imagine is going to stoke pretty furious reactions in America. You mentioned CBAM, the Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism, as one of them, where even if America is not intended to be one of the major targets for what Europe wants to do on the sectors that are covered, exports from America will be affected by it. And Europe has so far done very, very little in order to negotiate pragmatic solutions with countries that we do know make different type of efforts in order to reduce the carbon content of the products, even if they don't do it in the same fashion as Europe is doing it. We also know that, I mean, look, the major motivation for CBAM has nothing to do with environment. It has to do with European competitiveness. It's a competitiveness measure, of course. So I suppose that's going to have, at least going to land in a pretty bad way in Washington as well. We have the AI Act coming in, which is going to probably deny market access in Europe for many AI-based services from America. We already see Facebook saying they can't introduce their Llama in Europe. We have Apple, who is not selling the new iPhone 16 in Europe because of digital regulations in Europe. So Europe can do a lot in order to avoid causing frictions. And I would argue this is a good opportunity for Europe to basically review its stances it's taken, think through whether they are adequate or whether they are something we should stick to, given not just the broader global outlook with trade, but also because of our own economic interests.
Absolutely. I completely agree with that because if you look at, not just the Trump administration and what they might do going forward, but you look at the Biden administration in the last, 3.5, 4 years, they've also taken a fairly tough stance towards Europe. And I think that what we can learn from that is exactly that, that there has to be some sort of reflection on some of the policies that have been put forward in the EU, some of them without, a lot of reflection about what the implications are going to be, right? We have action on AI before we've also had a global conversation about what this all means and what we should be regulating and when. So I think that there's a moment of pause here to kind of step back and say, okay, what can we all do better here? It's very easy to criticize the Trump administration for having very bold America First protectionist policies, but perhaps we need to look at ourselves too and say, hey, what are we doing that could be better? How can we strengthen the fabric of the global trading system? How can we actually make trade more fair and equitable? And I think there's a lot more that we can do there if we hold to true principles about what it matters in sort of preserving the trading system to creating an open environment for global competition. Yeah, perhaps we could actually achieve something more positive here. And I think Trump's going to force folks to think really strongly about that. And maybe that would be the one positive outcome that comes from all of this is that we kind of step back and say, hey, there are things that we could do better here, and maybe we'll get there slowly but surely. But honestly, no one is free from blame in erecting protectionist barriers, subsidies. We've seen a huge global subsidies race evolve over the last couple of years. So there's plenty of blame to go around, and we can all do a lot better than we have been.
Now, that's a very good point, Inu. Coming finally then to issues around the trading system, as you talked about, and making investments to it. So Trump is not a favor of international trade rules. I think we know that already, nor was Robert Lighthizer. I think if we were going to portray the American position over the last 4 years during the Biden administration was basically an attitude to avoid dealing with institutional issues, right? For instance, the appellate body and whether you can get functioning dispute settlement going in the World Trade Organization. But there were some openings when it came to negotiating frameworks and participating in conversations, to some extent also a few rulemaking initiatives that have taken place. What do you think are the prospects for that dialogue to continue and these negotiations to maintain relevance? I'm thinking about, for instance, sort of e-commerce, digital type of issues where America would have a very strong interest to see development globally. Do you think, you know, is there going to be any type of presence of America in these institutions going forward under Trump too, or do you think they're just going to pull away entirely?
So I would say, you know, I'm curious to see what happens in January, who certain appointments are going to go to, who's going to be the new WTO ambassador from the United States, who's going to take a place at USTR to kind of give us a better understanding of this. But if we look back to Trump's first term, there was engagement on WTO reform. We did have an interruption from the pandemic. And I think that had we not had that disruption, we perhaps could have actually gone further on the WTO reform agenda than we did, right? Because once that happened, everyone kind of went back to the capitals and we stopped coordinating a lot of our policy approaches, stopped negotiating new rules. It was very difficult to make any progress there. So I think in a Trump 2.0, we could actually see a little bit more movement there. I am skeptical that there's going to be any effort to dismantle the WTO. I think a lot of people have put that forward. Bob Lighthizer himself said if the WTO didn't exist, we'd have to create it again in some way, shape, or form. So I think that there is a sense that you can change things, and I think there is a compromise that potentially would be available to make that happen. But I think there are some areas where we could advance some of that discussion. One of the Trump administration's proposals in the last administration was to look back at the role of developing countries in the WTO, especially in differential treatment that's afforded to some groupings. You know, China benefits from that as well. So I think that's an area where we actually should be having that discussion. And this is a good opportunity to relaunch those discussions. And on the e-commerce side, I think that we're likely to see a shift in tone under a Trump administration on e-commerce, potentially more participation and U.S. engagement on that, because digital trade is going to be an important issue that I think Republicans are going to want to have dealt with, not just in bilateral pacts, but also globally as well. Because, you know, at the end of the day, U.S. companies are a major contributor to the digital trade environment, and I think protecting those interests is going to be really crucial for the Trump administration as well. So I'm really a little bit more positive than others might be in terms of the hopes of doing things at the WTO, despite the fact there's going to be a lot of friction along the way. And it's hard to tell what's going to happen in terms of who the next director general will be, because we do know that Trump has not been favorable to Ngozi. So there could be changes there. But overall, I think we could have a chance to revitalize some of the discussions and maybe have the WTO go into a little of a back burner of the bigger things that are going to happen in trade over the coming years.
All right. Thank you very much, Inu. That has been a very, very good discussion. I've learned a lot from it. So thank you so much for taking the time.
Well, thank you, Frederick. Always great talking to you.